KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and thank you for listening in today. Today I'm actually doing a live show. I haven't done a lot of them here, but I am very pleased to have on Harry Serdin. Harry is a fellow at Codex, and Codex is one of the fascinating programs that is run at Stanford University that is similar in some ways and different in some ways with the organization that I'm affiliated with, the Center for Internet and Society. One of my goals of Hearsay Culture, for those of you who are listening regularly know, is to try to allow people to understand and learn more about what's going on here at Stanford, both at the law school, but also at the university in general. And Harry is working on a program, which I'll describe in a little more detail, but then Harry and I will discuss in greater detail, that focuses in the intersection of computers and the law in a much more specific way than CIS does. By way of brief background on Harry, Harry is a resident fellow at the Center for Computers and the Law, and the acronym that we'll be using today is Codex. Harry received his JD from Stanford in 2005, and he was the recipient of the 2005 Stanford Law Intellectual Property Writing Award. And he's worked also as a research assistant to Professor Larry Lessig, for whom I work as a resident fellow. Harry also was a law clerk to the Honorable Martin Jenkins in the United States District Court for the Northern District of California. And he was also, which relates directly to the work he's doing at Codex, a software engineer for Cisco and for Bloomberg. So, and actually, and one other thing that Harry and I have in common, other than both working for or having worked for Professor Lessig, is he received his undergraduate degree from Cornell. And although we were the same year, I never met Harry at Cornell, but I'm really pleased to have met him here at Stanford. So what are we talking about today? We're talking about the Codex Center. And Codex is a program that has its connections both in Stanford Law School, but also in the massive computer science departments here at Stanford. So I'm very excited to have Harry on today to talk about Codex, what it does, what kind of projects it's working on, some of the interesting problems that they're dealing with, and Harry's thoughts on them. And I think it'll be an interesting discussion that will allow anyone listening, both whether you're at Stanford or listening on the internet or listening by podcast, to find out a little bit more about this new and very innovative program. So it's a lot easier today to say, welcome to Harry. Harry, are you on the other side of the glass?
Yes, I am.
Terrific. Well, you know, I mean, I usually do these interviews by telephone, and I'm always nervous that the connection is going to cut out. But this is easier because I can actually see you.
Yeah.
So
won't run out.
Yeah, exactly. Unless you ran away, and it is locked from the outside. So, actually, it isn't. I'm kidding. Harry, being listening very intently, wanted to point out, and he's absolutely right. Actually, Harry was class of '95, so we overlapped, but we didn't actually graduate at the same time. But we still went to Cornell. I got that much correct. Harry, thanks for being here today.
Dave, thanks for having me.
Let's jump right in with the obvious first question. Tell us about Codex. What is it?
Well, Codex, or the Stanford Center for Computers and the Law, as we're also known, is a cross-disciplinary research center jointly run by Stanford Law School and the Stanford School of Engineering. And the mission of Codex is to apply methodologies, principles, technologies, and ideas from engineering, primarily at this point computer science, to the study of law. So the general thought is that there are useful ideas in research coming out of engineering that could be helpful in the law. That's the idea in a nutshell.
And now, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I was going to, I mean, you probably anticipated my next question, which is who founded it? When did it start up?
So Codex is a relatively recent center, and it was founded by professors in both the engineering and the law schools. Primarily, the professors from the engineering side are Michael Genesareth, and from the law side were Peggy Radin and recently Mark Lemley. And one point that you mentioned earlier, which I wanted to follow up on, is sort of distinguishing the work that we do at Codex from the other work being done in computers and the law that you're involved with and with that your listeners are probably more familiar with. So over the last 10 years or so, there's been a lot of activity in computer law, which typically involves issues such as intellectual property, which are copyrights, for instance, patents, file sharing, and also issues of privacy. And there are many fine centers at law schools, such as the Center for Internet and Society that you are affiliated with that are engaged in this discipline. So the way I describe it to distinguish our work from your work is to say that your center is involved in the law of technology, and at Codex, we're engaged in the technology of law.
So that's an interesting flip, and I think a part of that stems from, and you can explain in a little more detail, the direct connections that Codex has with the computer science department. And maybe you mentioned a couple of professors at CS who are working through Codex. Maybe you could describe a little bit more that relationship between the law school and the computer science department as it relates to the work that you're doing.
Yes. Well, from a high-level perspective, the key part is that the center is fully cross-disciplinary. So let me just provide a little bit of background. For the last 40 or so years, there's been a very interesting subdiscipline of computer science known as artificial intelligence of the law and the law. And the researchers in this area have done a lot of very interesting work. However, at least in the United States, artificial intelligence in the law has primarily been the domain of computer science researchers. So our goal at Codex is to equally engage lawyers and legal academics in this type of research, not just to make this an area of computer science, but a subdiscipline of both computer science and law. And so to that end, we've involved in our research, as I mentioned, computer science professors, law professors, and researchers and students like myself who have both computer science and law backgrounds, or who simply have one or the other.
Now, the Codex was founded relatively recently,
right?
And what ultimately are its core goals? What is Codex looking to achieve at this point?
Essentially, we believe that there are problems within the law that can be solved, or at least in various issues that can be improved by applying technology. And there are a similar problem is that there's the idea that there are analogous problems that have been well studied in computer science that are also occurring, theoretical problems that are occurring in the law that researchers in the legal field aren't aware of this work. And part of the idea is translating ideas from one domain to another. And that's been a lot of my work, has been this translation.
The one of the challenges at CIS is, as you mentioned, we're at the law school, and so we're heavily focused on law, but there's so many policy issues that come up regularly. And I think one of the real challenges that I've found, certainly practicing in this area, is that you have lawyers who are very proficient in the law and are familiar with the law, but of course, whether it's patent law often or even various other areas of law, you need to ultimately at some point have some grounding or at least understanding of how computers operate, how the internet operates, and what have you. And I'm curious, this is more of a personal question as to your background, but what got you to the point based upon your background that you wanted to do a fellowship at Codex?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'd have to say that, so prior to law school, I was a software engineer, and part of being a software engineer is solving specific problems. And, you know, as I gained various experience solving specific software problems, when I came to law school, I started to see a whole bunch of similar problems occurring in the law, like as I just described. And as I went through the legal literature, I realized that, you know, there was just a complete unawareness that some of these problems, these very same problems existed. And I realized that there was this really interesting opportunity to sort of juxtapose computer science and law, particularly at Stanford, which has a great computer science department, a great law school, and there's a lot of synergy there. So, and throughout law school, I had a lot of interactions with various computer science professors and students, and this sort of idea flourished. So when the center was formed, it was really a natural fit for my background and my interests.
The what brought me to wanting to work in this area was the intersection of intellectual property law and technology law, and the fact that there were so many new issues kicking in. You are, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, coming at it from a slightly different perspective because of your background as a software engineer. Maybe you could describe in a little more detail that experience. And I know that you started at Codex in August of last year. So it's a relatively new fellowship, but I'm curious, up to this point, What are you finding, or have you gathered any insights at this point that you're comfortable sharing about how your background as a software engineer has helped you or influenced the work that you're doing at Codex, which will transition us into discussing in some detail how that cross-disciplinary nature of Codex manifests itself?
I think it's been both ways, this transition. So, for instance, I find myself in the computer science domain sort of looking at some of the research that's going on and casting a critical eye from a legal perspective and saying, well, that's possibly not quite as simple as it seems, at least superficially. And, you know, by the same token, looking at some of the computer legal research and legal theoretical issues, you know, I cast an eye on that and I say, well, that seems very similar to the work that's being done in the computer science area. I know there's possible skepticism or hesitation to employing technical means of solving some of these problems, but why not give it a try? And it's sort of this optimism. Let's just try and see what we can do with this.
You've been generous, giving me a tour briefly of the computer science building, and I've seen the robotics and the work that's going on there. It's an exciting opportunity to be involved with Codex, but as we discovered and as talking to you about this, one of the issues, of course, is that you're actually physically at the computer science school. So I'm curious how that interdisciplinary world manifests itself in the work that you're doing now. And maybe that leads me into really what is the next question, because as I took a look at your website for Codex, and the website for Codex, for those of you that want to learn more, is Codex, which is CODEX. .stanford.edu. Again, it's Codex, CODEX.stanford.edu. But I'm curious, how would you define, what does it mean when we say legal technology?
So legal technology covers a wide range of topics. Essentially it ranges anywhere from legal informatics, mm-hmm. Which is sort of giving lawyers tools to sort of deal with the information, to sort of highly abstract and programs and technologies involving artificial intelligence or sort of automated reasoning. And legal tech is kind of a broad area, and it manifests itself anywhere essentially where you can identify an area of the law that you think could benefit from technology.
One of the really interesting questions that comes up when we talk about legal technology, it kind of runs the gamut. And some people think of legal technology, they think of programs that allow you to do tax returns and things like that. Or they think of legal technology as the ability to send an email to a court or to file a document with the court. You're talking about something, I think, quite much more broad than that. So I'm curious, maybe you haven't had this experience yet, but when you say legal technology to people that aren't attorneys or aren't technologists, have you gotten a sense of what they think it means, or have you been able to glean any sense of what kind of education needs to be done to educate the general public about the meaning of a term like that?
Well, so you said something interesting earlier, which is a lot of people think about legal technology. One of the instances is using software to do their taxes. Mm-hmm. Now, I happen to find that a very interesting instantiation of legal technology, because it basically proves a certain concept that, there's been, some skepticism. Can you use technology? Can you represent the laws in computers?
Mm-hmm.
To some degree, this is what tax preparation software such as TurboTax are doing. Millions of people use this every year. And this piece of software is representing what is perhaps the most complex body of law in the world, and roughly 30 or so questions, and that can accurately and pretty reliably produce a tax return that, will pass muster with the IRS. So that's a pretty amazing accomplishment if you think about it. And if somehow that idea, that methodology behind that could be generalized and applied to other areas of the law, that would be a great boon to many people.
It's one of the areas I think we'll discuss in a little while, but focusing on that tax return concept, there's a humorous commercial that's out right now for one of the tax preparation software companies, and it shows a couple, presumably a husband and wife, and a husband has been audited by the IRS. And the husband used one of those software in order to prepare to return. And the partner comes up to the man and says, well, what are we going to do now? Because you used a box, the box being, you know, he's holding the package of software to handle this tax return. Where are we going to get the human advice? Who are we going to turn to as an individual to help us with the next step? What it's suggesting, of course, is what this commercial identifies as a limitation of the technology, which is the inability of it to think outside the box, quote unquote, and no pun intended. Well, how does that factor, the human element of technology, factor into the kind of thinking that you're doing at Codex?
So this is a very, very good point. And I want to emphasize that a lot of the work we're doing is on tools. And these are tools to be used by humans, but they're not in any way, shape, or form meant to replace humans or human advice. So some of the work that we do based upon computer logic basically elucidates various non-intuitive information that's already in information that you have, that it's just very hard to draw out by looking. It's very hard for a human to draw that out. So a lot of what we're doing is manipulating information and presenting it in a way that's more useful than it otherwise would be. But I wanted to get back to something, another point you mentioned earlier, which is about the cross-disciplinary nature and how that manifests itself in at the Stanford Center for Computers and the Law.
Okay.
What's interesting is that there are areas of interest that computer scientists focus on, and there are areas of interest that lawyers focus on, but often they're really the same area of interest. You just have to translate one into the other. Hmm. So I'll give you a good example. So over the last 30 or 40, 50 years, it's been well recognized that there's been an explosion in the number of regulations that basically govern our behavior, legal regulations at the federal, state, local level. You know, at this point, hundreds of thousands, millions of regulations that we are all supposed to, we're supposed to conform our behavior to these regulations, whether or not you know about them. And so to a computer scientist, this is the problem, classic problem of information overload and efficiently dealing with information. Now, lawyers aren't particularly interested in information overload. However, I gave a talk a couple weeks ago where I presented the same problem as the notice problem to lawyers, and suddenly
what does that mean? Just with the notice problem.
So, what the notice problem is in law, there's this very powerful idea which intuitively we're familiar with, that individuals should have reasonable and fair warning about prohibited conduct ahead of time. So basically, you're not punished for conduct you didn't know was wrong. So the idea being, you should have a reasonable chance to figure out what laws govern your behavior. So what's happened with this proliferation of laws is that this process of, you know, determining what laws govern your behavior has become much, much more difficult. And so this translates into this problem of notice. You know, is it really fair to be punishing somebody for regulation, you know, 59,604
right,
when you practically couldn't have known about it?
Which leads into one of the other interesting overview questions that I wanted to kind of touch on a little bit, which is kind of the mystery of technology. You know, I've had a number of guests on the show who are intimately familiar with technology. Some are not, but most people are at least using modern software applications. They regularly use email. They use IM, things like that. Obviously, you and I are immersed in this stuff, and there's a lot of people at Stanford that are. But there's a lot of people, lawyers and everyone else, who aren't using the technology, and moreover, are adverse to using it. What is Codex looking at, or is it something that's coloring your thinking, the issue of making the technology itself more user-friendly and more accessible to the average person?
Yes, actually. And that's one of our, especially one of my personal goals as part of this fellowship with Codex. So one of the consequences of artificial intelligence and the law, which is where much of this work has been done previously, and which, as I mentioned, is a subdomain of computer science, is that a lot of the work that's come out of this has been done from a computer science perspective, you know, aimed towards computer scientists or what computer scientists' conception of the law. So they've done a lot of really interesting work on things such as case-based reasoning, which is sort of taking a legal case, you know, a Supreme Court case, for example, modeling it in a computer form, and then trying to figure out why, you know, the Supreme Court came out one way or another based upon various mathematical models. Mm-hmm. Now, that might be very interesting, and it actually has a lot of practical applications in some areas, such as, you know, predicting outcomes. There have been some of these projects have been highly successful at predicting outcomes in various areas. But in terms of practical use for lawyers, I, you know, as a trained attorney myself, I just don't see this appealing to a wide variety of lawyers. However, when I do talk to lawyers and I say, you know, what are some of the problems that you think legal technology can help out, I hear a lot of interesting answers. I was just speaking to a gentleman, a law professor who, for free, represents prisoners in what are known as habeas cases, which are cases where prisoners are sort of at their last end. They've already been convicted, and they're basically saying, "Hey, I've been unconstitutionally convicted. Please take another look at this because something went terribly wrong." So it's a very important safeguard in the legal system. But as you might imagine, there's an incredible shortfall of attorneys willing to represent prisoners for free.
Right.
So one of the interesting bars to a prisoner filing his case for habeas corpus is something called the statute of limitations. Now, the statute of limitations is a pure time calculation. There is, you know, a date A, and you have a certain number of days from date A to file your lawsuit, and if you file it after that, absent extraordinary circumstances, your lawsuit for habeas corpus is going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a very mechanical calculation, a calculation that could be, I believe, performed in many cases by computers. Right now what happens is typically prisoners wait in line till they get a pro bono attorney who will sit there, do this simple calculation, and say, "Oh, I'm sorry, your claim expired, you know, a month or two ago." Now, if there were these sort of simple tools that lay people could use to engage in some of these simple but very, very important calculations, and it's hard to overstate the importance of statute of limitations in some of these cases where your whole case is gone if you blow a time deadline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are very simple legal applications that have the chance to make a very, very big impact on people's lives.
The challenge there, and I think the challenge that I want to get into by discussing Project Calc and computational law and things like that after the music break, boils down to, I think, what is one of the most interesting missions and goals of Codex, which is to act, as you put it, to focus on how technology impacts the law itself and what we can do with the technology. And I think after the music break, we can talk a little bit about computational law and Project Calc, and of course, the question that you were alluding to earlier that I want to dive into more deeply, which of course is a question of pure self-preservation, which boils down to where are lawyers left if Codex achieves all of its goals. So with that horror scenario, of course there's a horror scenario for lawyers primarily, but that with that horror scenario and perhaps that cliffhanger, we'll take a short music break. You're listening to KZSU, Stanford University, Hearsay Culture, and the guest today, fellow for Codex at Stanford University, Harry Certain. Before we come back with Harry, I did want to do what I often do and try to do when I am doing a radio show on KZSU, which is to ask you for money. So get ready. If you love what you're hearing right now on KZSU, please help KZSU maintain its excellent programming. KZSU is a non-commercial radio station that depends on the support of its listeners to continue broadcasting its diverse range of music shows, sporting events, news, and public affairs shows by visiting kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, kzsu.stanford.edu, and clicking on Donate to KZSU or writing Underwriting at kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, kzsu.stanford.edu. You can do your part to make sure the independent sound of KZSU never dies. So, Harry, we're back, and I wanted to dive right into some of the concrete projects that you're working on at Codex. Tell us a little bit about Project Calc.
So Project Calc is one of our most interesting projects. So computers are primarily good at organizing information, analyzing information, and displaying information. So the goal of Project Calc is to study ways of representing laws in forms that computers can understand and reason about. And the implications of the ability to be able to do that are, pretty vast. As I mentioned earlier, there is this problem of notice. Having the ability to represent laws in computer form would at least be one step towards addressing this notice problem. So one could imagine having tools for organizing laws, for figuring out which laws govern a particular behavior. But just to be more specific about what Calc we're doing in Calc, we've picked an area of the law, which is the building codes, for various reasons, which I can go into if you want. And we're deciding whether we can represent certain regulations within the building codes within an area of computers known as computational logic. Some of your listeners may be familiar with logic in general. If then, it's an area of philosophy of being able to basically derive non-intuitive knowledge from an existing base of knowledge. And it can be very, very powerful. It's one of the most fruitful areas of computer science. And once you're able to represent laws in logic, and we call this computational law, the ability to do that, once you're able to represent laws in logic, you can do all sorts of interesting things, including testing to some degree for compliance with the law under certain circumstances. So to give you an example, we're working on building a demo system that will allow architects to test their building designs, which are already done in computer form. Mm-hmm. We're going to allow them to test for compliance with certain building codes, sort of a spell checker, if you will, for building codes. Now,
Before you go on, I did want to ask you a little bit more about that, because building codes wouldn't be something that I think would be intuitively the area you'd want to focus. So maybe you could describe a little bit why building codes are the focus of this work.
Well, part of the reason – there are a number of reasons. There's been a lot of work studying why it's very complicated to represent a law in computers. So I don't want to underestimate the difficulty of that task. There are computer science theoretical issues in doing this. Primarily, they are involved with making sure that you're faithfully encoding the text in computer language, faithfully representing. And then there are all sorts of corollary issues, which are who should be doing the encoding, because it's essentially an act of interpreting the law at some level. And then on the other hand, and I think this is what we at Codex really bring to the table in terms of having a cross-disciplinary center, there are legal theoretical issues involved in faithfully representing a law in computers. As any student who has taken one semester of law school knows, everything is not as simple as it seems. Mm-hmm. You have a law, but then there are all sorts of behind-the-scenes considerations that you start to quickly learn and become the bane of any law student. You realize that there's ambiguous language, language that's unintentionally ambiguous. There's intentionally ambiguous language. The legislature writes a law that they want to push off at a later time for the courts to deal with. You realize that there are contravening laws. Law 1 says A, and Law 2 says not A, and which one do you pick? You learn that there's exceptions to every law. So there are all sorts of these complicating issues that, combined with the computer science theoretical issues, make this a challenging task.
I do want to talk about computational law, but in listening to your answer, one thing did occur to me. I'm not trying to do a continual compare and contrast between Codex and CIS, but one thing that I think is significant is that certainly one of the things that CIS does is public interest litigation. And certainly it's fair to say that a lot of the work that CIS does is advocacy in nature. Codex doesn't have that focus, am I right? I mean, Codex is not, we're not talking about advocacy kind of work that you're doing at Codex. So just so that the listeners are clear on some of those differences, I'm right about that, correct? And you're nodding yes, so I just want to make sure that everyone understands that. Let's talk about computational law. Again, the phraseology is interesting. What does that mean?
So computational law is this general idea of representing laws and logic, but computational law has another twist to it. So there are sort of two acts you can do. You can represent an existing law in computers, and that implicates all of the problems I talked about previously in terms of interpretation and extra textual legal considerations. But then sometimes you can create new law on your own. And this is always a big and interesting shock to students in law school, primarily in the area of contracts. In law school, they tell you that contracts is also known as private lawmaking, because you're essentially, when you're creating a contract, binding yourself to a commitment to somebody else. But it's completely up to you how to specify the terms. Well, that's a whole new story. In computer science, if you have the ability to precisely and specifically define what every term means, that's a very powerful ability. If you can say this means something and nothing more than that, you've eliminated half the problems. Beyond that, computer science, has all these computational law has these abilities to make decisions based upon these very precisely defined terms. So, for instance, if you create an electronic contract, if you model it in this very precise language, and the contract is based upon a certain file arriving at a certain place at a certain date, you can check all of these things. So it has this application component that gives great power. And when you combine this with multiple complicated regulations, the power increases exponentially. And increasingly, we're moving this way where a lot of policy, a lot of information that we can use to make these sort of decisions, yes, this applies or yes, it doesn't, is being continually implemented on the web. So there's a movement out there now called the semantic web, which is enabling all sorts of
semantic, as opposed to the company.
Yes, I'm sorry. So S-E-M-A-N-T-I-C, not the company. Right. So semantic as
I'm sure semantic would the company would love it to be the semantic web.
Right.
Yeah.
I think they're trying to get that, but that's not our goal. Semantic being meaning, and all that means is that the semantic web gives you a bunch of tools for more precisely defining what you mean. And then once you have things defined more precisely, you can do complicated reasoning. So, for instance, in the computer science department, they're working on something called semantic email. So you could say, send this email to all people who graduated from Cornell in 1995. And, you know, it would send that to me, but not to you. But that's the idea that because assuming that there is a database out there that has this ability to say this person was in Cornell, they graduated from Cornell in 1995 and this person wasn't, you can make this sort of logical decision. The computer can make it. And, you know, you can imagine that multiplied many times over in complicated contracting regimes, and suddenly the power of computational law becomes evident.
So this is moving away from Boolean logic and that kind of stuff, which undergirded a lot of the search efforts, or the search engines and things like that, whether it's Lexis or Google or what have you, were founded on this Boolean logic idea. And what you're suggesting is that some of the technology that is being addressed at Codex is looking at making it, ultimately getting back to an initial question I was asking about, more user-friendly in that sense.
That's right. Yeah. And even though fundamentally at its base, it is still based upon Boolean logic. It's building up layers of abstraction that allow new, interesting, non-intuitive reasoning on the part of the computer that these sorts of tools are enabling.
Well, let's ratchet up the abstraction one level higher, if we can, which is to get to that horror scenario for lawyers that I mentioned earlier. Is this technology, or is a conception of this technology, going to make lawyers themselves obsolete? This is, again, I mean, if I had the sound effect behind me, I'd do a da-da-da. But what's your response to that concern or that question?
So I get this question a lot when I tell people this is what I'm doing. The question is, oh, so you're trying to automate lawyers. My answer to the question, will lawyers go away, is unequivocally no, nor do I think is that a desirable goal.
Uh-huh.
Fundamentally, lawyers are advocates for people. They're representing the best interests of their clients, or at least they're supposed to be. And quite often, it's incredibly useful to have a disinterested party representing your rights in the complex legal system. So for that reason alone, I don't think lawyers will go away. But for the more pedestrian reason is that, quite simply, the computer technology isn't capable of making a lot of these decisions, nor do we want the computers making these decisions, in my opinion. A lot of seemingly simple decisions are, at their base, animated by public policy, human interest, all sorts of these important contextual issues that you want people involved in making that decision. You want a judge sitting there hearing from witnesses and hearing from family members of a defendant in a criminal case before the judge decides how many months of jail sentence they're going to impose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want this human element. And there's going to be an element of law that computers are not going to replace, nor should they replace. On the other hand, there are a non-trivial number of mechanical tasks in the law that lawyers don't like to do because they're repetitive and boring. Clients don't like to pay for it because it doesn't seem particularly sophisticated. And I think that everyone pretty much agrees that eliminating this percentage of mechanical tasks, and it's a very small percentage, I estimate maybe 10% of laws are amenable to this type of mechanical process would be a tremendous boon to the legal industry. I mean, if you look at any other area and you say, I can offer you a 10% improvement in efficiency, you get a lot of excited people. And,
right.
You know, it's like informatics in the law and word processors. And a lot of lawyers used to have, instead of typing things up, they used to have their secretaries type things up, and there were multiple stages of, you know, dictating into a machine. And, you know, I think for the most part, people are happy that those days are gone, and the day of easy editing documents and, you know, efficiencies are here. And in a similar way, we're hoping to realize this vision for, you know, some of these mechanical tasks.
I think you've we don't have a lot of time left, and so I do want to follow up very quickly on the issue of the ability of computers to reflect and analyze human emotions. I had Colin Rule on several months ago. Colin is the online dispute resolution director for eBay and PayPal, and has focused a lot on online dispute resolution issues, given the fact that there are these conflicts on an hour-by-hour, minute-by-minute basis on eBay and PayPal. And I asked him the question of the ability of the technology to reflect things that are not calculable by a computer. In other words, if someone wants to resolve a dispute, but what they really want is an apology from the other person, it's hard for a computer program to assess that, or the emotion behind a statement, which is legendary when it comes to email, the classic issue of really misinterpreting an email because you don't hear the inflection or the humor or the lack of humor behind it. It leads to that question, which unfortunately we don't have a lot of time to get to, but I'll ask you quickly, which is, if there was one thing you would say you don't want technology to be able to do or to reflect, what would it be?
That's a really good question, and I think it does represent the sort of lay conception of or a lot of these conceptions represent this lay conception of the law as this simple monolithic thing taken out of context, as you identify, within the larger context that every lawsuit is ultimately a conflict of rights between entities, whether it's a corporation versus a person, or a person versus a there's this human element. Laws govern human behavior. There aren't a lot of laws governing the behavior of computers. That's because,
right.
Well, there are, but they're computer rules.
Right, or they're in movies.
Right, there are human laws. And this is because laws fundamentally about human rights and conflicts. So I do think we do want humans in there sort of mediating for the most part, and also making these crucial distinctions, and also having the ability to sort of see outside the box, to see the larger picture, to enable settlement and negotiation. So I think it's a great point, and something a place I personally would not like computers to go.
Well, I think we can go on that level of abstraction for quite a while. And if I had a 3-hour block, which would destroy your voice, my voice, and I'm not sure how many listeners we'd have left at hour 2 minutes and 50, we could continue further. I will invite you back sometime later in the year to discuss some of these issues. But in the remaining couple of minutes that we have, I do want to give you the opportunity to tell in very brief form some of the other projects that Codex is working on.
So one of the most interesting projects that we're working on is something called the Stanford Intellectual Property Exchange, and or IPX for short. And it's very interesting because it involves elements of computational law and some of the most important intellectual property issues that are here today. So I'll just briefly explain what the idea behind it is. There's a notion in economics known as transaction costs, and as the name suggests, that simply means it is the cost of doing an economic transaction. So, for instance, if you have an iPod that you want to sell on Craigslist, and the iPod is worth $100, but selling it involves flying on a plane, buying a $1,000 plane ticket to New York to sell it, the transaction costs $1,000 of the plane ticket outweigh the value of the profit you're probably going to make. So there's the quick idea of transaction costs. Transaction costs have this problem in that when the transaction costs are greater than the value of the transaction, a lot of things don't have, a lot of transactions that would otherwise happen. So computers are famously good at reducing costs, reducing transaction costs. So this is especially pertinent in the intellectual property context, where today, if you want to, so say you have a song, you want to license a song,
right?
This process involves retaining a lawyer, having your lawyer contacting another lawyer. There's negotiation. It's a tremendously expensive process.
And great for lawyers.
And great for lawyers.
Yeah, of course. All kidding aside.
So what we are working on is essentially a computerized version of electronic licensing. So if you imagine a world where a MySpace user wants to legally license a song and put it on his website, right now he can't do that. But if he could gain permission to do that, say exchange for a banner ad or something of that nature, that would be a boon. So we're working on systems based upon this idea I described before of computational law to enable online licensing of sort of arbitrary complexity of any of these intellectual property ideas.
Mm. It's the IPX is something that I think we could talk about in much greater detail on the next program, and it's something that I'm personally interested in, given the Orphan Works issues and others. But unfortunately, we've pretty much run out of time here. Harry, I do want to thank you for coming by today and discussing Codex. And to the extent that people want to learn more, the website and how can they contact Codex or learn more about what you're doing?
So, if you're interested in learning more about Codex, please visit our website, which is codex, C-O-D-E-X, .stanford.edu. And please send an email, where they're all listed on the websites, and somebody will get back to you. We'd be happy to discuss your interests further.
Terrific. Harry, thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
I want to thank Harry again for being on today, discussing Codex. As is often the case, I think maybe a 90-minute block might be good, but certainly we cover a lot of interesting territory, and I do encourage you to learn more about Codex by going to the website codex.stanford.edu. A couple of quick announcements, which is first, I have a number of shows coming up the next several weeks I'm looking forward to. Next week, Professor Frank Pasquale from Seton Hall Law School will be on discussing search engine regulation and the issues surrounding that, which is a really fascinating issue and quite controversial. And then I'm having a couple of authors on as well. Richard Lanham from UCLA, who's written a fascinating book called The Economics of Attention, will also be on to discuss his work. And he's been writing in this area for quite a while, and I'm very excited to have him on. And looking at technology from a very different perspective, but fascinating, is Julian DeBell, who wrote a great book called Play Money, about his experience actually basically having a bit of a career selling virtual loot, as he calls it, but basically selling items through Second Life and virtual worlds. So I'm very excited to have Julian on as well. And additionally, in the coming month, I'm going to have Steve Aftergood from the Federation of American Scientists, who focuses on government secrecy and looks at the wide range of issues that come into trying to get government information and access government information to figure out what's happening behind the scenes. So I'm very excited to have all of those guests on coming up in the next month. Additionally, I've been a broken record to date myself even further about this issue, but I am actually quite close now to launching a website connected with the show. And literally today, I was actually working on putting the content up. Right now, the site is password protected, but so that you have the address, it's quite unusual and I think counterintuitive, but the name of the website is hearsayculture.com. I know it's shocking and you may be confused as to why I call it that, but that is the website. Like I said, right now it is password protected, but once it's been beta tested, which basically means I'm going to show it to a few people and say, does this make sense? Then it will be live. And so I finally worked out the technical glitches, and I thank Joe Nito and Lauren Gelman and Kent Howard and everyone who I've worked with at Stanford and Ben Costa as well, who have given me guidance guidance on trying to get everything going, and they've been wonderful. And Joe, in particular, is responsible for making the podcast work, and so I thank him for that. So you've been listening to Hearsay Culture. My name's Dave Levine. Coming up is Mike doing his eclectic range of music on Baptism of Solitude. I thank you for listening today. Again, you are listening live to KZSU and Hearsay Culture, and I look forward to talking to you next week, although it will be recorded. So be well, and of course, always, you can learn more about CIS by going to cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And otherwise, in the next, I'd say probably by the end of January, I'd say go to hearsayculture.com, www.hearsayculture.com, and please email me and let me know what you think of the site. Again, thanks for listening, and have a great day.